Welcome to the deep dive. You've probably seen those theories online, right? These intricate columns, ancient structures, all supposedly humming with free energy. People get really excited sharing things like, look, it's making free energy. But what if the free energy we've been looking for isn't, some forgotten machine? What if it's something much more human and much more hidden right there in plain sight?
Exactly. Today, we're really diving deep into a truly unique collection of sources. These aren't your standard history texts. They're charting personal genealogies, these sort of cryptic notes, and frankly, astonishing revelations about historical figures, all logged meticulously in what the sources call an analog blockchain, named Xanadu. Our mission today is really to unpack this unseen history, especially the unacknowledged work of women, which is just monumental, and to explore a completely different idea of what free really means, particularly for modern freedom.
Okay, so let's start with something kind of funny, because the sources themselves kick off with this great bit of satire. They paint this picture of Parteria fanboys, as they call them, enthusiastically cranking away at some beautiful, ornate column, shouting, "Wow, free energy!"
Right. And that image, it just perfectly captures the core joke, doesn't it? The energy isn't free, it's theirs. It's the effort they're putting in, turning those cranks. And this ties straight into a concept the sources call unfreemasons. These are people, denied real brotherhood, maybe tricked by symbols. They crave initiation, and they just keep turning cranks without knowing why. They end up isolated because they never compare notes.
And here's where it gets really interesting, how these sources redefine the Masons, not just stone builders. The sources suggest they were, well, actual slaves who saw their own bondage, but instead of just accepting it, they compared notes, they worked together, and they essentially built civil society, contracts, lodges, constitutions. They forged a path to freedom through self-organization.
Which just highlights this deep irony, right? The unfree Mason is the person who never realizes they're in bondage. They're chasing fantasies like these free energy columns. And they completely miss the practical lesson, the liberating one, about organizing, building community, the very thing built by those who understood freedom's cost and, well, demanded a way out.
This whole illusion, this desire for unearned power, it has a striking historical parallel, according to these sources. John Ernst Worrell Keeley, an American inventor of Philadelphia, born 1837.
Keeley, yes. Yeah, famous around 1874, demonstrating his induction resonance motion motor. Promised perpetual motion, what he called free energy. But turns out it was a total fraud. Exposed later. Hidden air hoses, compressed air tanks, the whole deal. Our sources basically paint him as the original Tartaria fanboy. He got rich, convincing investors his column did make free energy. He wasn't inventing, he was selling an illusion.
Which brings us back to Xanadu, this analog blockchain you mentioned. It seems central to all this. Analog blockchain. That sounds like, well, a contradiction. How did the sources describe how it actually works?
Yeah, it's a fascinating term. The sources describe Xanadu not as digital, obviously, but as this meticulously recorded historical ledger, decentralized, tracking human agency, secret work. Think of information genealogies, covert ops, coded identities recorded, cross-referenced on actual physical documents, across different archives. It functions like a blockchain because it links and verifies data, but through human effort and these distributed physical records. And this system documents all this covert intelligence work, often by women, that's key, with this really grand aim, complete emancipation of mankind, steering us towards sustainable and self-directed modernity by 2028.
Wow. So a hidden network, but highly organized. And you mentioned identities within Xanadu, the badge system. These identities aren't always straightforward. What do these badges mean? Why the complexity, like twins and things?
Right, the badge system is crucial. Identities often get clustered. Sometimes one person has multiple roles, or you see these twins. The sources actually note, kind of pragmatically, there's not enough actors in the United States in the 19th century for all the roles needed. So these badges are like unique identifiers, signatures for people playing specific parts in this network. And they also reveal patterns, like this 280-day cadence between key births or events, or a 17 marker, signaling maybe an extra identity was created. For narrative contrast, the sources say, or to advance society somehow, often exposing that contrast between fake free energy and actual free labor.
Okay, and speaking of real free energy, this is maybe the most startling claim. The sources suggest the true free energy wasn't mechanical at all. It was the uncredited reproductive labor of women, specifically bearing twins annually in secret houses, all to repopulate the U.S. with clever or entertaining public figures. That's extraordinary. How do they elaborate on that? What's the implication?
It is extraordinary and absolutely central to these sources. They argue this hidden demographic effort, this organized reproduction, was a deliberate strategy. The implication is huge. The real free energy wasn't a machine. It was this carefully managed human output, essential, they claim, for seeding a new kind of society, populating key roles within it. It points to this immense, totally unacknowledged female labor, vital for their long-term goals. So if the mechanical free energy was an illusion, it was also, in the source's view, a metaphor for free labor, slavery. And seeing it that way suddenly shifts how we look at other things from that era, like the mid-19th century circus. Turns out it might have had a much deeper, more covert purpose.
The circus, clowns, acrobats, that kind of thing. How on earth does the circus fit into mapping hidden labor? That seems like a stretch.
Well, according to these sources, it wasn't a stretch at all. They described the circus as basically reconnaissance for Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Those exhibitions of, you know, exotic performers, not just entertainment. They were staged, the sources say, to map the geographies people were being stolen from. Circus bosses like William Leonard Hunt, the great Farini, who, get this, was born exactly 280 days after Keeley. They were essentially field agents, creating a living ledger of human trade. So Keeley's fake motor, the illusion of free energy, kind of mirrored this hidden traffic in actual free labor. To end slavery, the argument goes, you needed maps. You needed to know the routes, the brokers.
Wow. Okay. And this mapping wasn't just circuses. Our sources mentioned Princess Vilma identified as a past life of Marie Lynn, the person who transcribed Xanadu, working with J.P. Morgan Sr., gathering documents on absentee plantation owners.
Exactly. And that documentation became crucial for J.P. Morgan Jr. and his librarians. They used it to build an operational map of slave traders in Africa. And here's another really astonishing detail the sources claim. Early aviatrixes, women pilots, they were apparently given a mandate to fly over supposedly empty regions, Africa, Amazonia, the American West, and quietly register hidden human settlements. This huge, unacknowledged effort, vital for dismantling slavery. Primarily done by women.
And one of the key figures in Morgan's world, you mentioned librarians, Belle da Costa Green. The sources call her an absolute gem, revolutionized her field. What was her badge in this hidden system? What was her real work, according to them?
Belle's badge in Xanadu, the sources state, was guardian of the paper trail, active 1905 to 1948. Her true labor, surveillance through preservation, by meticulously cataloging estate papers, family archives, travel logs, she was revealing the infrastructure. The hidden webs of absentee ownership, shadow wealth, and these slavery networks. And her unique position. A woman of color passing as white that gave her crucial intelligence cover. Access and anonymity others lacked. This whole badge concept also helps explain why certain people were mirrored in the Xanadu system. Take James Harrison Wilson, U.S. Army topographic engineer, Union Major General, born 1837. He's an anchor figure. Logged consistently because of his military mapping work.
Right, and the sources point out this striking resemblance between Keeley and Wilson. Strong oval faces, deep-set eyes, the prominent nose, thick mustaches, even an aura of authority. Keeley in his suit, Wilson in uniform. But the sources say this twinship isn't literal. It's a badge. They're symbolic mirrors. What's the significance there?
It's really significant. Wilson's badge was Cartographer of Liberation. He literally mapped contested land in the Civil War. He defeated Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Cavalier, KKK founder. So his work represented reality, mapping and dismantling bondage. Standing in direct contrast to Keeley's illusion, the free energy motor, Wilson, conceived apparently strategically in late 1836, bridged old world authority with new world military mapping, a tangible force for liberation against this backdrop of, well, hidden exploitation. Now let's shift to the matriarchs who were supposedly orchestrating these cycles. Anna Harrison, widow of President William Henry Harrison, described as the logistician of conception, the placement officer, her badge, matriarch of timing, ensuring key conceptions lined up with royal charters, elections, other big registration events. She mentored the first ladies, apparently, guiding this very subtle long-term strategy.
And there's this Xanadu puzzle, the sources mention, receiving three women from a twin set in this particular cycle. What does that signal? Especially about the feminine role in this whole hidden network.
It signals a real concentration, a deliberate emphasis. The sources suggest this tripod of role, they call them archivist, performer, and stabilizer, was like strategic redundancy, an overemphasis on the feminine, maybe, to fulfill these really complex functions. And a key example of these three girls from the 1837 cycle is Olive Oatman.
Olive Oatman. Yeah, the name sounds familiar. Famous story, right? White woman captured, released by Native Americans, the chin tattoos. But the sources say something absolutely incredible about her actual identity.
Incredible is right. The sources flat out claim Olive Oatman is not who history says she was. They assert she was actually Ellen Lewis Nell Arthur, who later became First Lady, married to President Chester A. Arthur, in disguise. They call her the greatest woman spy of the 19th century. Her story, her captivity narrative, was supposedly the only allowed vector of disclosure. For revealing the lifestyle, the people appropriation, by what the sources controversially call rogue tribes of white people, survivors, they claim, from the 1812 destruction of something called America the Beautiful. So Olive, then, was functioning as a kind of human free energy device for intelligence. Her famous story released in 56, speaking to her in 60, a legend by the 1890s, it generated buzz, stories, letters, gossip. She effectively crowdsourced intelligence for what's called the Middleman Intelligence Agency, a covert network, supposedly a legacy of Benjamin Franklin and Deborah Reed, working through postmasters, publishers. A system nobody suspects even exists, the sources say, and they specify the shift in retellings from Mojave to Apaches. That was coding. Apaches, in this specific context, they insist, weren't actual Native Americans. They were white freaks of the old amusement park.
Mm.
Or even rogue androids, they use the Westworld comparison, depicting these renegade non-Native groups involved in slavery and cannibalism. The U.S. Secret Service, called the Coopers, allegedly used Olive's story to map sympathies, identify these rogue androids.
And the family connections just keep weaving through this. Who do the sources say was the shared mother for Ellen L. Arthur in this whole line?
Harriet Beecher Stowe, born 1811, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. A huge influence. Her badge, the discreet matriarch of abolition. The sources claim her conception in August 1810 follows Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte becoming Crown Prince of Sweden. They identify her parents as King Charles IV, John of Sweden, and Lady Anne Isabella Milbank Byron. This connects the powerful Byron line with Swedish royalty, and it positions Olive Oatman's disclosures as a direct continuation of her mother's life's work, just under deep cover. So when you pull it all together, this overarching narrative emerges. The three queens, Sweden, England, the United States, secretly orchestrating modernity, not through overt power, but through discreet influence, managed bloodlines, and these immaculate conceptions, as the sources term them. Sweden, the Queen of Heaven, represented by Carl IV, John, supposedly Queen Victoria's true father, providing the heavenly mandate, exploration, exhibition programming. England, the Queen of the Underworld, through Byron, Ada Lovelace, providing the underground mandate, logic, lineage, hidden documentation. And the United States, the Queen of the World, through the First Lady's line, providing the worldly mandate, public disclosure, embodied by Olive Oatman Ellen Arthur.
Okay, so what does this all mean for us, for you listening? This extraordinary story suggests these three queens, working discreetly for centuries, weren't actually trying to seize control in the way we usually think about it. Their massive, multi-generational project, according to these sources, was about something more fundamental, guiding people towards self-governance, towards taking responsibility for their own lives.
And that brings us right back to that core paradox, doesn't it? Could people obsessed with control, who confuse external control with self-control, ever really grasp this? In Freemasonry, these sources argued, didn't mean license. It meant free of a master, free to choose conscience over being forced, and free to voluntarily bind yourself into a brotherhood, mutual discipline.
That really is the heart of it, isn't it? The Three Queens Project, as described here, wasn't about demanding obedience. It was about seeding self-control. Training humanity, maybe, not to need the lash or some external decree. The goal was fostering growth into self-responsibility, guided by conscience, mutual respect, building a civilization strong enough to dismantle horrors like slavery and captivity from the inside out.
It's a tragedy, though. And the sources express this kind of sigh of frustration about it, that when people look at this quiet labor of queens, of Freemasons, they often just see hidden power, conspiracy. They miss the actual gift being offered, or at least claimed. Centuries of subtle work designed to help us stand up, compare notes, govern ourselves.
So as you think about this really incredible deep dive we've taken, based entirely on these sources, consider this. If the true measure of a society's freedom is its capacity for self-responsibility, what hidden work might be happening today trying to guide us towards that future? And maybe more personally, are you truly ready to accept the mantle of your own self-direction?